Welcome to the weekend. I'm Angela Cocherga. On this episode, we begin a series of conversations about COVID-19. The goal is to go beyond the grim numbers to examine some of the issues and disparities exposed by the pandemic. We'll also look back to see what we can learn from the past, including the Spanish flu here on the border, and we'll explore some ideas about moving forward. We'll take this long view with the help of authors, historians, and researchers. Just ahead, a conversation with Dennis O'Hearn, an award-winning author and dean of UTEP's College of Liberal Arts. His book subjects range from Irish economic history to the Zapatistas in Mexico. He also wrote a biography of Irish hunger striker Bobby Sands. But first, an up-close look at the current COVID-19 health crisis through the eyes of a nurse. Nurses have been on the front line caring for patients, coping with the shortage of personal protective equipment, and in some cases, getting sick themselves. Gabe Montellano, a UTEP student journalist for Borderzine, an online news magazine, began interviewing a nurse back in March. Originally, the story was about Latinos in nursing, and then the pandemic happened.
Good afternoon. My name is Mario Murillo. I'm an RN, BSN, working currently at University Medical Center under the critical care area.
Because of social distancing, Murillo agreed to record his own answers to questions about working during the pandemic. He's 26 years old and he has been a nurse for 4 years.
We are feeling tense. We do try to prepare as much as we can, but it does feel more like a calm before the storm situation more than anything else.
When we first talked in mid-March, patients with COVID-19 were beginning to show up at the hospital. According to him, nurses at his hospital were also coping with a shortage of personal protective equipment.
We have been having to reuse material in a way that in any other situation would not be appropriate. We do feel anxious, we do feel a bit nervous, but it comes with this job that you know and have to find out a way to deal and continue working and providing for your patients in anxious or nervous situations.
In late April, Murillo had to temporarily stop caring for patients and isolate himself when he tested positive for COVID-19.
And having to be self-quarantined has been a roller coaster of emotions, to say the least, between dealing with the symptoms. The illness itself has made me go through different range of emotions, whether it be anger, guilt, sadness, or anything of the sort. But like with anything else, just have to find a way to deal with them appropriately. And at its time, really, we all are humans in the end.
At home, he had to take precautions to protect his parents and brother and sister from the virus. Fortunately, none of them had been infected. That meant isolating in his room as much as possible, having a designated restroom, and wearing a mask.
Wearing a simple surgical mask to lessen the risk of contagion, and whoever is next to me or is going to be helping me out with anything has to also be wearing a surgical mask and staying 6 feet away. I'm also making sure that any food items I get, they are in disposable utensils. Third, I'm also not having any physical contact with my pets due to the risk of coronavirus spreading to them and from them spreading over to other family members.
His family has 3 dogs. After recovering from COVID-19 and getting retested, Murillo returned to work in June. He's now caring for patients in the ICU.
There are pathogens everywhere, and it's safe to assume COVID-19 is roaming the halls of every hospital in El Paso.
He hopes by sharing his story, people will take all the necessary precautions to protect themselves from the virus.
Because this thing is very much real. The threat is very much real.
For KTEP, I'm Gabriel Montellano.
To read more about this story and others by UTEP student journalists, check out borderzine.com. COVID-19 deaths are spiking in sister cities on both sides of the border. Fatalities are much higher in Mexico, but combined, El Paso and Juarez deaths total more than the largest county in Texas, which includes the city of Houston, a big hotspot right now. That's according to a recent analysis by the Dallas Morning News. There's also an interactive map showing COVID-19 cases along the border. That's at dallasnews.com. And now to our conversation. My guest co-host is with the Dallas Morning News. He's the border in Mexico correspondent, Alfredo Corchado, and he's based here in El Paso. And joining us now is Dr. Dennis O'Hearn, Dean of UTEP's College of Liberal Arts and an author, to talk about the impact of the pandemic in our region and beyond. And again, my guest host for this interview is Alfredo Corchado, correspondent based here on the border for the Dallas Morning News. Welcome to both of you, and thank you for your time.
Great to be here.
Good to be here.
Well, Dr. O'Hearn, really want to draw on your expertise here on the border, but also your experience in Ireland as well, and some of the lessons from your book, The Biography of Bobby Sands, Nothing But an Unfinished Song. Let's start with the pandemic and what you're seeing, and maybe some of the parallels between Ireland and our borderland.
Well, you know, there is a very interesting thing which has to do with the degree to which pandemics affect certain kinds of populations. And, of course, most of his life, Bobby Sands, who, you know, became famous around the world as a hunger striker in 1981, was involved in a sort of lockdown in prison in which they were kept in very horrific circumstances. And, you know, with no reading materials, nothing else, no clothing, and basically had to create a sort of oral community by shouting at other prisoners through the walls. And there was always a fear then in that situation, that there would be various kinds of pandemics, I guess, if you want to call them, or epidemics that would run through the prison. And, you know, so prisoners, I think, and certain populations, of course, now we see people in retirement homes who are particularly prone to the virus that we're seeing now, have a kind of special vulnerability. And quite often they're also the people who are not protected and who are kind of put away by the population, by, you know, state institutions and so on. And so that makes them even more vulnerable. And I think those parallels are really quite interesting.
Well, to backtrack a little for people who may not be familiar, tell us about Bobby Sands and his hunger strike.
Well, Bobby Sands was a young fellow who really didn't have any political background, but, you know, who went through a period of youth where, you know, he underwent a lot of kind of attacks, both by the police, which were almost entirely Protestant, by the British Army later on, and those kinds of things politicized him because his community basically was really coming under attack. So in a response to that, as a very young fella, he joined the IRA. He actually came from a kind of a, more of a Protestant background than most of the people who joined the Irish Republican Army, but, you know, was kicked out of the area that he was living in because his mother was Catholic. And then they were forced into a Catholic area. And they underwent a lot of harassment by police and by the army, the British Army. You know, it's that too has some parallels with what we're seeing today when we see people, you know, because of their ethnic background, lying on the street with knees on their necks for a long period of time. So anyway, I mean, that, you know, that was kind of the background to his politicization. He spent most of his adult life in jail or in prison, really, because he wasn't, although he was active in the Irish Republican Army, he was not, you might say, a very successful guerrilla, urban guerrilla, in that he kind of got caught a couple of times and basically spent his whole adult life in prison. But while he was in prison, he really learned a lot. I mean, he learned the Irish language, for example. He read voraciously. He built all kinds of, you know, organizations and ties between the different prisoners by learning poetry, writing and singing songs, doing history classes, Irish history and world history, all kinds of things like that. So his main contribution to the prison community was by organizing groups of people to do things that basically raised the morale, but also made them more into a solidary community where everyone was working for each other. And that was particularly important between 1976 and 1981, when the hunger strike broke out, because everyone was kept in solitary confinement. They were not allowed any clothes. They were not allowed any reading materials or writing materials, and anything that they had of any kind of comfort basically had to be smuggled into the prison through visits that they had with their family and friends and so on. So it was a very bare and horrific existence that they were living for those 5 years. And, the one thing that helped them to get through it was the leadership of people like Bobby Sands, who organized various kinds of activities, and particularly learning activities, that helped the prisoners to come together and have a purpose in that kind of a terrible environment that they were in.
Well, really important to see those parallels and the relevancy of that experience even now, as you said, in so many ways. Also, the comparisons between Ireland and our borderland, you've been thinking a lot about that since you've been here.
Well, I have, because one of the responses to the problems that were happening and basically the conflict between different sections of the population, I mean, primarily Catholics and Protestants, but also, I mean, this was mediated by the British Army and by the police, which was entirely Protestant. One of the things that happened in Belfast, where I was living for a long time during this conflict, was that a number of walls were put up and highways were built right through the different communities, basically, as a form of security. There were almost 100 walls, I mean, by one count, 99 walls that were built in Belfast between 1969 and the year 2000. And it's interesting that they were still being built in 2000 because the peace process in Northern Ireland began in 1994. So they were still building walls for 6 years after the peace process was going on. Today, almost all of those walls are still there. And that's another thing I think that has been important to me is that, you know, when people are talking about building walls, those walls go up, but they're extremely hard to come down. And people have been talking about bringing down the walls in Belfast since, you know, the early 2000s. But only less than 10, only a handful have come down. So the vast majority of them are still standing.
So, Dennis, what's the lesson for this border community? The El Paso Juarez, the U.S.-Mexico, the Texas-Mexico border. And we all know that the wall's been going up for the last few years, especially during the Trump administration. We're now in a pandemic. Does that mean that the wall will continue to go up? It'll be hard to bring it down?
Well, I think it's interesting what's happening in the pandemic right now. Quite often, conflict and, a crisis is used to kind of impose various kinds of new things on a population. In 2008, 2009, for example, when there were big bailouts of the corporations used the big money to fire a lot of their employees and come back at the cost of the public with a much smaller workforce. So unemployment was created by public spending. Andrew Cuomo has been making a big thing of that recently in his daily addresses. And, one could see that there would be an attempt in by the regime, particularly by the Trump regime, to use crisis as an excuse to impose a lot of things on the public. And so, he's trying to stop movement of people as if, the virus came in from either China or Mexico. We know the virus came in primarily from Europe. But at the same time, I mean, that can be used as an excuse to build walls, to build physical barriers, to try and stop the movement of people as if that would stop, the movement of the virus. The kinds of handouts which are being given, and a lot of them are going to corporations and to businesses of one kind or another, could often be used to, build up the corporation, buy new machinery, which would basically replace employees. And, that's something that I think, we need to look at. On the other hand, a crisis can also create a new kind of rising of both hope and, new demands on the part of the population. And we particularly see that right now in terms of healthcare. Some things that, you know, were not being seen as possible during the Democratic primaries, for example, like a single-payer healthcare system, now seem to be back on the agenda, mainly because all of those people who supposedly love their insurance companies and, you know, had their insurance through their work, many of them find themselves now out of work, and they don't have access to those great insurance policies that that were talked about during the Democratic primaries. So, you know, there's two forces really going on, a kind of double movement. One is a movement by certain people and institutions to use the crisis to impose more constraints, more challenges to civil liberties, more challenges to human rights. And then on the other hand, you know, it creates new demands on the part of the population. I think we're going to see that really working out in the coming, you know, electoral process.
One of those trends you talked about is countries become more nationalistic, countries become more insular. Can a binational community like El Paso Juarez survive without one another?
No, and I think that's one of the very interesting things that you know, I learned from Belfast. I mean, you know, once those walls went up, they were meant to keep people apart, but they were also meant to give the security forces a different kinds of better way of manipulating populations and controlling them. And they had a number of very, very, you know, negative impacts on the populations. I mean, first of all, of course, they create division. And as you know so well, this is a single community. I grew up, you know, in this region and like many people in El Paso, you know, went back and forth between El Paso and Juarez whenever, you know, we visited the city. So we always saw it as one city, and division itself is kind of a form of violence against the population. It creates longing. People long for the kinds of solidarity, the family ties, just the freedoms that they had to go back and forth in the past. And, you know, those were things that were lost in Belfast as well. It creates blight. Once you put walls up, you have various kinds of blight on either side of the walls. And quite often it creates various kinds of PTSD, frankly. A wall is something which is a kind of violence against a community. And I think, you know, it does have long-term impacts on people's health and their psychology.
Dennis, one last question on my part. Give us a peek into the future. It's too early to talk about a normalizing or normal life, but give us a peek into what this region will look like in the post-COVID-19 era.
One thing that I've been really impressed by since I've been here or back in this region, you know, I grew up as a child, I grew up in the region. But one thing I've been impressed by is the degree of community. I mean, there's a terrific amount of solidarity and community among the people on both sides of the border. And that's really something that I kind of came to cherish and value in Ireland as well. I think that's something that it's very, very hard to take away from people. You know, when people have that kind of kindred spirit amongst each other, that kind of solidarity, that's something that really doesn't come away. And, you know, I could see into the future, you know, that people will be rebuilding new ways of refining each other. They'll try to find new ways to make connections, to recreate community and solidarity, as I think people have done. But, the coronavirus, I think, has kind of put people into a sort of a shock where they're trying to rediscover, you know, meaning. What is life about? And I could see that playing out in all kinds of ways. There's a very interesting video, which is a poem, actually, which is on YouTube at the moment. It's called The Great Realization. It's British, so realization is spelled with an S, if anybody wanted to look it up. But what it is a poet who's talking to his young brother and young sister about what the world will look like after the virus. And it's a very hopeful picture. It's a very hopeful idea that, you know, now that we're reconnecting with people, you know, virtually, but we long to have solidarity and connection with people. We're finding new ways to do it. People are finding new ways to perform music, to do theater and other kinds of things in public in a way that they never did before. And we're beginning to see how important those things are to our life. So the things that we miss because of the virus are things often that we took for granted. And I think as we move out of the virus, there will be a strong sort of impetus for different sectors of the population to recreate those things. You know, we're also seeing more wildlife. We're seeing skies. You know, there are certain cities that are, you know, always polluted. And even in El Paso, you know, the level of pollution in the skies is much less than it was before the pandemic because there's a lot less traffic. So, I think people enjoy seeing that. And they say, you know, could we live a life in which we'd be a lot more environmentally, friendly? We see the sales of electric vehicles, for example, is going up in many countries around the world. And so I could imagine that would be an impact. A lot more renewable energy sources, a lot more uses of things that are environmentally friendly.
Well, one last question on my part. I mean, we have seen the border in the past be a place of innovation and kind of going beyond what local, state, and obviously federal, international governments do. But we've also seen a new focus on the importance of these essential workers and who is considered essential. And clearly on the border, we have essential workers that go back and forth and people who, as you mentioned, may have been overlooked in the past. What do you anticipate there as far as workers?
I think that's a very, very important thing. You know, of course, the obvious thing are the people who are working in the maquila. And that's, you know, both provides employment, but in some cases provides some misery as well. I think, you know, that the idea that the people who work in the maquila are essential could lead, if people, you know, pay attention to that, to a new sort of force to try and improve conditions for the workforce in those places. But the other place, which is, of course, very important, and, you know, a lot of studies have shown that the closer people are to migrants, the more sympathetic they are. And I know people in New Mexico and Arizona and California, for example, and parts of Texas, see migrant farm workers who are basically very, very skilled people. They do stuff that other people can't do. They're essential, but they're also extremely skilled. And the idea that after coronavirus, we're beginning to realize that folks that we kind of took for granted are really skilled and important people could lead to, you know, a strong force to improve the conditions, to make it more possible for people to move freely, could help with, you know, the demands of labor to create better conditions in farms and factories and so on.
It's also important to note that many of these essential workers are undocumented. I mean, how does America reconcile the two, the cry for a wall, the dehumanization of the undocumented, but yet the need to have these workers, especially farm workers, you know, provide food on the table? I mean, when you go to these grocery stores, you have to realize that much of this fruit, vegetables, is picked by undocumented workers. Vast majority of them have no papers, have no legal authorization to work in this country.
Well, that's right. And I don't think we ever have really reconciled it. And by we, I mean, I don't think that the government or officials or really the population or many parts of the population have reconciled that. They kind of want to eat their bread and have it, or eat their cake and have it. They want to have access to this very cheap form of labor, but at the same time, they want to be able to continue to impose the kinds of restrictions, the kinds of civil liberties issues that have been done. I would hope that coming out of the coronavirus that, you know, and particularly because we do have a rising Latinx population, for example, rising Asian populations in this country, that there is a possibility that we'll have a new dialogue, which will be a much more welcoming dialogue, which will see diversity as something which is a real asset for our society. And of course, we've seen recently in recent years with white supremacy and other things that, you know, there is also the possibility of a rise of the other side of that argument. And we've seen this country kind of divide. But, you know, again, by looking at the way in which the community in El Paso comes together, the things that have happened with the number of folks who have come to the border looking asylum over the past couple of years, and the reaction of people in El Paso to welcome them as friends, to provide things that, you know, that they need, whether it be food or clothing or, you know, even shoestrings, you know, little things that help someone to maintain their humanity in a very inhuman situation. That's a very encouraging thing. And I think, you know, El Paso can go forward as really a beacon of what our post-pandemic society can be like. And it can be a welcoming society. It can be a healthy society, and it can be a society of solidarity where basically we treat each other as neighbors and friends and people who we can reach out with love and respect.
And people who literally in many cases are family. So seeing that humanity in each other, even as we have had to isolate for a while.
Well, absolutely. I mean, and we are now seeing family again. In a new way. You know, I think it's something that, again, that in this region, in Juarez and in El Paso, family has kind of retained a lot more of its meaning to people than it does in many other parts of this country. You know, family has kind of gone into the background and the whole idea of extended family, partly because people move so much. They live in so many different places. Now with new technologies of being able to have video meetings with people, and, you know, people are even coming together to have a drink together or to, you know, play music and sing together and things like that. That is opening up new possibilities for rediscovering not only family but community in a way that has been lost in this country, in many parts of this country.
I was going to say one of the things that I lost and picked up during this pandemic was the beautiful art of reading, and I can't say enough about your book, Dennis. The biography of Bobby Sands, Nothing But an Unfinished Song. Go out and get it. Hopefully at the Literarity or online. But
well, let's go down to Literarity and tell them to get a bunch of copies in, you know, maybe do a reading once we are able to do those kinds of things again.
There you go. It's a great book.
But it's certainly available on Amazon.
Or a virtual reading, another one of those virtual
activities.
You can
have a virtual reading, exactly.
Well, thank you so much for your time. We know you have to run, but Dr. O'Hearn, it's been wonderful hearing your insights and reflections during this difficult time, and also some hopeful messages. So thank you again.
I think hope is something that we really need to cling to in this kind of a time. And you know, we can come out of this in a better world. It's an important thing to do. And I really appreciate everything that you guys have done to tell El Paso's story. I think that's important that we do tell our story and put it in a positive light, because this is a community that has much to be proud of.
Thank you so much, Dennis.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for listening to this edition of The Weekend. Our next pandemic conversation will feature Borderland historian David Romo. I'm Angela Kocherga, and this is KTEP 88.5 FM, your NPR station for the Southwest.